I'm Marty Moscow, and welcome to Radio Times. Hillary Clinton battled Bernie Sanders late into the night last night to win over Iowa caucus-goers. She declared victory, although less than a point separates the two Democrats.
So as I stand here tonight, breathing a big sigh of relief, thank you, Iowa! I want you to know, I will keep doing what I have done my entire life. I will keep standing up for you. I will keep fighting for you. I will always work to achieve the America that I believe in, where the promise of that dream that we hold out to our children and our grandchildren never fades, but inspires generations to come. Join me. Let's go win the nomination. Thank you all, and God bless you.
It was a close race on the Republican side, with Ted Cruz defeating Donald Trump and Marco Rubio a very close third. Here's Ted Cruz declaring victory.
Let me first of all say, to God be the glory. Tonight is a victory for the grassroots. Tonight is a victory for courageous conservatives across Iowa and all across this great nation.
Today in Radio Times, what happened in Iowa and what it means. And we begin our conversation with Catherine Lucey. She's government and politics reporter covering Iowa for the Associated Press. She used to cover Philadelphia politics for the Philadelphia Daily News. And Catherine Lucey, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Oh, it's great to be here. Good morning.
Good morning. Well, let's begin with Ted Cruz, because he seemed to defy some of the pollsters. And how was he able to beat out Donald Trump in Iowa last night?
Well, I think the big story and the big question mark going into last night was, how important was organization versus momentum? And on the Republican side, we saw that Ted Cruz's organization really saw him through. He had spent a huge amount of time in the state. He had organized a ton of volunteers. He had pastors. He had brought people in, and he was housing them in a former college dorms, calling it Camp Cruz. So he had a lot of time and energy into a very sort of traditional Iowa caucus organization, and that I think that really was a key part of his victory last night.
He did go to all 99 counties in Iowa, something that other winners in Iowa, especially on the Republican side, had done. Was that a path to victory, Catherine?
Yeah, I don't think that alone is a path to victory, although it's certainly a nice thing to talk about. But that was part of this bigger Iowa-heavy strategy. And in contrast, Donald Trump had giant rallies. He brought in tons of people, but he did not put the same kind of organizational muscle into the state. And I think that probably was a kind of key to the difference.
I thought it was interesting that Iowa Governor Branstad at one point didn't exactly tell people to vote against Cruz, but he certainly wasn't particularly supportive of Ted Cruz in Iowa. Now, he's a longtime governor in Iowa. Does that tell us anything?
I think it shows, as a lot of us think, that endorsements only mean so much. I mean, those weren't great headlines for Cruz. The governor typically keeps away from endorsements, but he chose to make the statements over the issue of ethanol, the renewable fuel, which is a big deal for Iowa, and Ted Cruz has opposed, government mandates for ethanol. So, that didn't look great, but obviously it was not the key issue for a lot of voters. Ted Cruz had a very, very strong support among evangelical voters, the conservative right, had done a lot of work to organize those folks, and at the end of the day, the one comment from the governor wasn't really enough to sway them.
So can we say that he got most of his support, Ted Cruz, from evangelicals in Iowa?
I think, I haven't seen all the data coming out of it, but certainly that's a big part of his support. And he's been courting those voters, really strenuously for years, coming to evangelical events. His father is a evangelical pastor, and he also has come in a lot to Iowa and talked to folks. So that is a key block for him.
We played a clip of Hillary Clinton declaring victory, although this was a real squeaker for her. Now, she did come in third back in 2008 and really was banking on a win in Iowa. Do you call it a win, Catherine?
It's a nail biter. They're very, very close. She declared victory last night. The Sanders campaign says they're still looking at it, I believe. I think she certainly is happy, it went this well, but I think she'd probably like it to have been a much more decisive victory. She came into the state big early. Like Ted Cruz, she invested a lot in, staff and organizing. She was here a lot. And I think she certainly wanted to vanquish some of the ghosts of 2008. So no doubt she's, gonna play really hard now in New Hampshire to try and, keep moving forward.
Well, Bernie Sanders certainly has his appeal. He came or is within half of a percentage point of Hillary Clinton. What did Iowans like about Bernie Sanders? And do they like what other people in this country like about Bernie Sanders?
I think it's what a lot of people like about Bernie Sanders. People found his message refreshing and exciting. I was at a lot of Sanders rallies, and he brought in lots of young people, lots of new people. People really like the way he talks about breaking up banks. They like his message on income inequality. People were really fired up by what they saw as sort of a new, I guess he's not new to the politics, but kind of a new voice. And I think that must be one of the things that the Clinton folks will now have to deal with, that I think Sanders, the polling going into yesterday really showed that he was doing much better with younger voters and had a lot of enthusiasm behind him, and that's something they'll have to grapple with.
What was the turnout in Iowa yesterday? Do we know yet, Catherine?
I believe on the Democratic side it topped 170. On the Republican, it was maybe 180,000, something like that. I mean, they were the Republicans were much higher than their previous records. The Democrats was a good turnout, but it didn't reach the levels they hit in 2008 when President Obama helped lift it to kind of historic highs.
I was watching last night, and at one point, I think in some of these precincts, it was so close between Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders, they did a coin toss, which is interesting.
I've seen those reports. That did not happen at the precinct I was at, so I don't, I think it is... It's often hard to explain to people. Caucusing is very different than primary voting, and particularly on the Democratic side, it's a completely sort of unique, arcane process. It's not a ballot. They stand up and form groups based on who they like. People argue, persuade, talk to their neighbors. It is a interactive, sort of community meeting, really.
And from watching, I mean, there was this place where I think it was just so close that they were trying to figure out who was ahead, Clinton or Sanders. And what was so kind of adorable, even quaint, it was pieces of paper, pencil, little plastic containers where the various, I guess, ballots or votes were cast. There was something so uniquely, I guess, Iowa about it.
Yeah, it is these are really community meetings. And so people are there with their friends, with their neighbors, talking about ideas. So I was at a precinct last night that was very evenly divided between Clinton and Sanders. They had a few people who were undecided, and each side had to try and persuade them to come over to their group. And you hear all these conversations about banking, about education policy, about gun control. I mean, it really was. This was a deep conversation, and it was really a fascinating watch.
Well, and kind of refreshing because so much of this race, and I'm guilty of it to some degree, is about the horse race. But it sounds like when it comes down to caucusing in Iowa, it is about the issues.
It is. I mean, the horse race and the polls, I think, affect everybody. But yes, And it's important to note that not everyone in Iowa caucuses. It's a minority of folks and a minority of registered voters. But the people that show up care deeply. And I was surprised that there were people showing up last night who were still undecided, that still wanted to hear from hear from both sides and had questions. And you would think that at this point, how could anyone have listened to this many ads and rallies and seen flyers and not know? But people were really being deliberate about their decision.
And asking someone else to persuade them, saying, persuade me, essentially?
Yeah, absolutely. So the caucus I was at, there was a captain for each side, and the captain for Clinton spoke at one point about how great it would be to have Bill Clinton back in the White House again. And when the groups were finished dividing, one of the people who was not committed said, I need to hear more than just Bill Clinton. What else do you have? What else can you tell me? So it was very up close and personal.
So are the TVs, I read something like $200 million spent on advertising in Iowa. I don't know if that's correct or not, but I'm assuming.
I don't have a number, but it was massive. Between all the campaigns and the super PACs, it was a huge amount of television advertising. Absolutely.
So is it the quiet after the storm today in Iowa?
You know, I'm in New Hampshire, so I keep going here. But yes, Iowa, a big storm was actually coming in just after the caucuses last night. So lots of Iowans, I think, are probably snowed in and recovering today.
Well, I do need to ask you, only because you covered Philadelphia politics for a number of years. So how different is it covering politics in Iowa? Now you're in New Hampshire compared to Philly politics.
You know, I would say Iowa and Philly are very different places, and people have very different styles of communication. You know, Iowa tends to be a little more reserved, but they are both very sophisticated political communities. So they're both places that take politics very seriously, which is a lot of fun for me.
So looking ahead, what, to the next week or so before the vote in New Hampshire, what will you be doing, Catherine?
I'll be here in New Hampshire for a few days, looking at a variety of candidates, kind of seeing how, I think particularly how Clinton and Sanders, approach this next stage. And I'm not sure then what, but I think it's going to be a eventful year, obviously.
There was some polling that came out over the weekend that seemed to predict that Trump was going to beat Cruz. Are people in Iowa beginning to rethink some of this polling data and polling analysis?
You know, polling may be a real story of this election. It's very hard to poll. The recent poll going into the last poll going into the caucuses from the Des Moines Register is a highly regarded poll that has a very good record, and it showed Clinton and Sanders incredibly close, but on the Republican side, it showed Trump ahead of Cruz. And it's hard always for polls to pick up every single thing that's going on in the field, especially when you have big turnout and new people coming in. So I don't think polls are going to go away, but they only capture so much, especially, as I said, there were a lot of undecided people still up to the last minute. And so that also, I think, makes it hard to capture everything that's going on.
Well, we have to let you go. Catherine Lucey, thanks so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome. She covers government and politics for the AP. Stay with us. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. We are talking about what happened in Iowa yesterday, what it means. Just a recap here. Ted Cruz defeated Donald Trump, who barely beat Marco Rubio. And this, of course, among the Republican candidates, a very close race on the Democratic side. Now, Hillary Clinton declared victory over Bernie Sanders, although that win was basically a statistical tie. So some questions still related to the results there. We have two more guests who are joining us now. Jesse Burns is political reporter at The Hill. And Jesse, nice to have you with us on Radio Times. Do we have Jesse? We will get him up. How about Josh Voorhees, senior writer at Slate, living in Iowa City? And Josh Voorhees, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks for having me.
That's you, Josh, right?
Yes, it is.
Okay, sorry. And Jesse, do we have you? No, we will get Jesse up and running. Let me then talk with you, Josh Voorhees, about what happened last night. Actually, and let me give out the phone number to our listeners as well, which is 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. So, Josh, what's your takeaway from last night?
Well, I mean, I guess on the Republican side, the first and always takeaway, it seems, of the past 7 months was Donald Trump. It was interesting to see that he didn't live up to kind of his beloved polling numbers that he loves to tout. This wasn't necessarily a complete shock. I think most observers and many kind of pundits and journalists looked at those numbers and suspected that they were perhaps stronger than kind of the reality on the ground. But ultimately, I mean, Donald Trump won a quarter of the vote in the Iowa Republican caucus. And that's a pretty stunning fact compared to where the expectations were last week. It seems like a disappointment. But compared to what we all thought when he jumped into the race last summer, I mean, that's a pretty stunning development. And Iowa certainly wasn't friendly terrain for him. It was always going to be a place where someone like Cruz, with kind of ties to the evangelical community, was going to fare better.
He's heading off to, or probably already is, in New Hampshire, and it seems a much more, friendly place for Donald Trump, Josh?
Yeah, I mean, he's currently up, and again, these are the polls, so take them with a grain of salt, but right. He's currently up 20 points there. He was only up about maybe 5 or 6 in the last week in Iowa, so he has a much larger kind of cushion in New Hampshire. New Hampshire's always been kind of the base of the Trump campaign, even before it was an official campaign, going back to the 80s when Trump kind of began with these head fakes to the media, pretending he might run, considering he might run. Maybe it was going to be the Reform Party. Maybe it was going to be the Republicans. It started in New Hampshire. It was a local New Hampshire, basically, I think county chair there that kind of first floated his name, and Trump picked up the ball, kind of saw the free media that would come with it and ran with it. Hmm. And he ran with it for about 4 decades until we get to this point. So I think New Hampshire voters are perhaps more familiar with Trump, if that's possible, than many others.
Well, let me get Jesse Burns in on our conversation again, a political reporter at The Hill. And Jesse, nice to have you with us on Radio Time. Sorry about that beginning.
No worries. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. We were just talking a bit about what happened on the Republican side. How do you see the Bernie Sanders, Hillary Clinton, I don't know, standoff, marginal victory? How do you see that, Jesse?
Well, yeah, anytime that both sides are declaring victory, it's, there are some winners and losers. Clearly, Clinton did not want to lose, and so she can at least say that she didn't. But it wasn't a decisive victory by any means. And, yeah, like you said, there are still some questions as far as, the margin of how much she actually won by, less than, half a percent. So it's certainly, in New Hampshire, Sanders is the clear favorite. Even if he wins, I think overall Clinton is still the favorite for the nomination. This, I think, in Iowa, the big takeaway is that she at least fended off Sanders from, getting a victory there. Which, she couldn't really afford to give him any momentum. But it's certainly not, a decisive win that they would have liked.
And didn't want to relive what happened in 2008 when she came in third after Edwards and Obama. Let me play a clip from last night. This is Senator Bernie Sanders talking about the message that he got from the voters in Iowa, and you think the message he believes that they are sending the rest of the country.
9 months ago, we came to this beautiful state. We had no political organization. We had no money. We had no name recognition. And we were taking on the most powerful political organization in the United States of America. And tonight, while the results are still not known, it looks like we are in a virtual tie.
Josh, you got to give Bernie Sanders a lot of credit here.
Oh, I mean, definitely. He started the race 50 points behind. Even last week, he was about 3 points behind in the polls. The Clinton campaign, which is always very cautious, and the kind of the lead up here, they suggested they were going to win. They were going to win, if not handily, at least comfortably. And that didn't happen. And I mean, I think what I've seen here over the past 6 months is certainly a pretty strong showing of kind of outpouring for support for Bernie Sanders, which is certainly not doesn't fit the mold of the type of candidate you would normally think could challenge such a someone who started as such a prohibitive favorite for the nomination. She has the backing of so much of the establishment, of many in the kind of the elite liberal opinion shapers and thinkers, if you will. So I think that the simple fact that Sanders managed to battle to a draw, as he's calling it, I think it's certainly something that does keep the momentum going. I don't think it's going to be enough to give him the victories he needs early in a place like South Carolina or Nevada. But as far as the movement that he's trying to create and the revolution he's calling for, I mean, he has the kind of the money and the motivation to carry on that fight for a long time.
And Jesse, I mean, it looks like he has had a lot of influence on Hillary Clinton, and even looking like he's moved her more to the left than perhaps her natural inclinations.
Yeah, absolutely. We saw that with the Keystone issue, where he kind of goaded her for not coming out months earlier. The trade partnership that the Obama administration was pushing for. Politics is so much about momentum, and I think going into the Iowa caucus, Sanders had all the momentum, and I don't think the results yesterday, I think they just kind of underscored that, the fact that he, could battle to that draw, and this is going to be likely followed up by a win in New Hampshire for him. So even if he doesn't, pull out some other early victories to get enough support for the nomination, he is definitely, coalescing and pushing Clinton further to the left on a lot of these issues, even going after her Wall Street ties, forcing her to defend those and forcing her to talk even a little bit more on income inequality. That's something that maybe we wouldn't have seen if he hadn't had this much support in the race.
Let me go back to you, Josh. I'm looking at a piece that you had in Slate, and this gets into some of the weeds of how specifically the Democrats caucus in Iowa. But I'll just read your short version of what this means, the support for both Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders. The numbers we see this morning are the party's best estimate of what the state delegations will look like, but they are still an estimate. It's really about selecting delegates who select delegates to go to the convention. Do I have that right?
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty much like a Russian nesting doll of a bureaucratic process. It starts with the last night people caucus to elect county delegates. Those county delegates then go on to other conventions, both at the congressional district level and the state level. And then so ultimately this number we see, and that's why we're dealing with weird fractions of what they call standard delegate equivalence.
Yes,
so
I saw that.
It's the weirdest and most anticlimactic metric, I think, possibly to use. But I guess ultimately, if you boil it down in a very specific way, if the question is who won the Iowa caucus, and it's always dangerous to talk about winners and losers, but in this situation, if we're talking about the actual agreed upon race, it was who could amass the most county delegates, which is what happens on caucus night. And in that case, Hillary won right now by, it appears, the equivalent of 4.5 state delegate equivalents out of about 1,400. So it is so remarkably close.
Yes.
But ultimately, she does get to declare victory, which I think it will be just enough to kind of keep the risk of panicking and overreacting in a way that we saw in the lead up to Iowa that started to hurt Clinton with some Democrats, she has to be very careful to avoid moving forward.
Jesse, and I'm not surprised to see this comment, Facebook comment from Doreen, Iowa results mean nothing. They're not a predictor. They're just first. And there is a danger of sort of over-interpreting or over-emphasizing what happened in Iowa. What is a reality check on that, do you think?
No, that's absolutely true. I mean, just looking at the Republican side, Rick Santorum won the last round in 2012. Mike Huckabee won in 2008. Both of them got, single digits under 2%. So it's definitely just the first. And for some of these campaigns, for Cruz, for example, a lot of pressure for him to actually win Iowa. So to some extent, it's just meeting expectations to do that. And, of course, you can't deny, the fact that he was able to kind of take down Trump in a first state, even if Trump picks up the next couple, like New Hampshire, where he's 20 points ahead. So for a lot of these, it's kind of managing expectations. And it can definitely add to some of the credibility for some of the candidates, like Marco Rubio, for instance, who overperformed compared to a lot of the polls going in, and can now make the case, this is a three-person race with him and Trump going into New Hampshire, where he, definitely is kind of battling for that second-place spot over Cruz and several others. So while it is only first, right, it kind of contributes to a lot of the narratives, a lot of the storylines, which can help some of these candidates going into these other states.
And that's Jesse Burns. He's a political reporter at The Hill. Josh Voorhees joining us as well, senior writer at Slate, living in Iowa City. We are talking about the caucuses last night, some of the results, some of the questionable results, I guess, when it comes to the Democratic side. And lines open at 1-888-477-9499. If you were in Iowa, who would you have caucused for? We're curious about that. Also, send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me go to another clip that we have. This is Donald Trump. Now, he did finish second, and he began by saying he was honored to finish second, and then he went on to say this.
We will go on to get the Republican nomination, and we will go on to easily beat Hillary or Bernie or whoever the hell they throw up there. Iowa, we love you. We thank you. You're special. We will be back many, many times. In fact, I think I might come here and buy a farm. I love it, okay? Thank you. Thank you, everybody.
Josh, he can say anything, can't he?
He can. I will note he was oddly subdued, and I know that sounded like a lot of bombast from Trump, and it was, but compared to what he was saying in the lead-up in the past 7 months, that was basically a civil, mild-mannered version of the man we've been watching.
But do you think, and perhaps it's too soon to tell, some of that luster might be coming off the Donald Trump's image or persona?
Well, I mean, definitely his kind of the implicit argument in his campaign is this odd circular logic of winners win and I'm a winner, so I'll win. So now that he's finally lost, I think it becomes a little bit more difficult. He loves to point to the polls. I mean, certainly the actual caucus results matter more than the polls. So it will be interesting to see what happens over these next 7 days before New Hampshire. But if he posts a victory there, I'm pretty sure we'll never hear him mention the words Iowa again, and it'll just be all New Hampshire, New Hampshire, New Hampshire.
Or the word loser again. Jesse, you want to weigh in on this at all?
Sure. The big question is now how Trump frames this second place finish, because although he, you know, was second place, it was almost a third place. You know, Marco Rubio was just behind him there. And so going into this, his big sell is that he's the winner. And so I think the benefit for him is that it's only, you know, just over a week until New Hampshire. So even if for the rest of this week he has to kind of dance around the fact that he didn't quite, you know, pull out a victory in Iowa, he has New Hampshire right next, and you know he's the favorite there. Right. I think another kind of key thing to watch for is how, you know, which candidate he goes after now, because the key rival in Iowa was Cruz. You know, that was the person he focused on for, you know, 3 or 4 weeks leading up to it. In New Hampshire, there's no clear rival. There are, you know, 4 or 5 candidates who are battling for second place, and so you know, coming out of Iowa in this caucus, it would seem that Rubio would have the most momentum. Of course, you know, Cruz too, who's in the mix in New Hampshire, can't be ignored either. But it would be interesting to see who Trump, you know, as still kind of the overall front runner, you know, nationally and in many of these other states, how he responds and who he goes after. A lot of his momentum is kind of stimulated by media attention and capturing the voice of the conversation, the debate nationally, and it's hard to do that when there's no kind of feuding going on. And so without a clear rival in New Hampshire for the next, you know, week or so, it'll be interesting to see, you know, who he goes after to kind of stay in the mix, stay in the spotlight going forward.
Josh, I've heard a number of, I guess what you would call establishment Republicans, criticizing Cruz more than they are struggling with Donald Trump running as a Republican. Why is the party, why don't they like Ted Cruz? And Donald Trump said everyone, he's a liar and everyone hates him. But what is going on here?
Well, I think there's two ways of looking at it. The first and kind of obvious way is Ted Cruz has not made a lot of friends in Washington. I mean, he openly admits that is actually part of his brand. But his Senate colleagues do not like him. It's pretty clear when you watch kind of the dynamics of what happens on the Hill and what happens on the actual floor. Recently, he was denied a very basic kind of motion on the floor that senators typically would grant anybody, and it was pretty much a pretty clear message. So there is some of this that that he's simply not very well liked. The other way to look at it, though, is that there's kind of some game theory going on here. It's possible to imagine a world where the Republican establishment, and that's a loosely defined term, of course, but they would actually rather it come down. They were hoping to knock Cruz out early. If Cruz wouldn't have won Iowa, all of a sudden, where does he win? Maybe he falls away. And then you're looking at Trump versus a non-Trump, and that non-Trump lane would have, in theory, been filled by somebody like Marco Rubio or maybe even Jeb Bush. But with Cruz, with this win, it's a chance that we go Cruz, Iowa win, Trump, New Hampshire win. And then all of a sudden, the establishment frontrunner is still kind of trying to still kind of carve his way into the conversation. And in a three-horse race, that perhaps is a little bit less of a likely – we're less likely to see the history repeat itself that we normally do, which is this outsider versus an insider with the insider winning.
Jesse, we have a comment from Charles from West Philadelphia. He wants to know what you think Christie will do. He did – I think he got a couple of percentage points yesterday in Iowa, and we're, New Jersey is part of our listening area. How do you see the Christie candidacy?
Yeah, well, Christie was very open even going into yesterday saying that he didn't expect to win Iowa. So, getting under 2% of the vote there is not unexpected necessarily. He has been going after Rubio for several weeks now, and I think you're going to see even more of that because Rubio coming out of Iowa is considered, potentially to be the establishment favorite and the person kind of best positioned leading up to the Granite State primary. So I would expect to see a lot more focus on that feud between Christie and Rubio. But definitely, Christie, he has hit at everyone. He's even hit at Trump, and Trump has hit back, saying, and they've probably had one of the closest relationships over the years. Trump's now not considering him a friend. And so that might be a storyline that kind of develops whenever kind of Trump goes after someone. He kind of forecasts it in advance to show that the relationship has fizzled to some extent. He did that with Cruz right before he launched into a barrage of attacks on his Canadian birth. Maybe we'll see that too. That could definitely even bolster Christie if the front runner starts going after him.
Well, we're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation talking about the Iowa caucuses last night, some of the results, what it means. Jesse Burns, Josh Voorhees, our guests. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen, and we're talking about the Iowa caucuses last night. The residents of Iowa did caucus, giving the nation a first glimpse of who might end up being a contender in the general election. We're discussing some of the results and the implications for those results. And again, our guests are Josh Voorhees, senior writer at Slate. He lives in Iowa City. Jesse Burns, political reporter at The Hill. And you can join the conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and I'll read some of those comments on the air. We were just talking about Senator Marco Rubio, who did come in third after Trump and after Ted Cruz. Let's hear what he said last night in Iowa.
If I am our nominee, and I will be our nominee, thanks to what you have done here in this great state, when I am our nominee, we are going to unify this party and we are going to unify the conservative movement. When I'm our nominee, we are going to grow the conservative movement. We are going to take our message to the people who are struggling paycheck to paycheck, to the students living under the burden of student loans, to the families struggling to raise their children with the right values. We will take our message to them and we will bring them to our side.
Josh, he came in third, but it sounded like a victory speech.
Yeah, he certainly seized the opportune moment to go on stage, too. He found kind of a nice little sweet spot in the cable news cycle. It is interesting, the Rubio campaign for the longest time here, as he's kind of emerged as the likely nominal establishment favorite, that there was a lot of criticism that there was no place on the map he could win. And recently the campaign has kind of publicly put it out there that their game plan involved a strong third place in Iowa, followed by a second place in New Hampshire, and then using that momentum to climb the ladder and post a victory in South Carolina. Obviously, a lot has to go right for that to happen, but this was step one. So it is a minor vindication of that. And I think the kind of the general perception of the competency of the Rubio campaign right today after that strong performance in Iowa is much higher than it was about 2 weeks ago when it looked like he would have a middling third and still be kind of stuck in the cluster in New Hampshire.
It seems like he spent a lot of time in Iowa in the last couple of weeks, as I understand it, Josh.
He did. He was actually, over the last 3 months, he was actually out here more than any other Republican candidate. The campaign did kind of a pretty good job of getting him out here and getting him in front of voters, but also downplaying the fact he was out here, kind of to keep expectations low, which is what allowed kind of that a third place to seem like a victory kind of on the night of the caucus.
We have an email comment from Joseph. He says, does the Democratic caucus in Iowa show that Democrats have two weak candidates? And Jesse, I guess by that I mean no clear winner, looking at both Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders.
Well, yeah, to some extent, I think what we saw in the Democratic caucus yesterday was kind of an underscoring of a lot of the demographic themes that we were kind of expecting to see. So Sanders got the overwhelming support of young people, you know, those under 30, while Clinton got the majority of support of those over 65 who make up a greater percentage of the overall voting block. And so there's that to kind of look at as far as momentum and any kind of parallels back to 2008 when we saw an insurgent Barack Obama kind of defeat her in some of the early states. And we also can look at the realization that although, you know, Sanders is viewed as much more trustworthy among Democrats than Clinton, she is viewed as more electable. And that kind of that split of her, even though, you know, only I think at the exit polls yesterday, some of them pegged it at like 10% viewing her as trustworthy, her positioning and something that her campaign has actually kind of leaned into of, you know, can you imagine Clinton as sitting in the Oval Office, that kind of commander-in-chief, that kind of presidential appeal can go a long way in at least Iowa evening out the scales to have the duel for a tie, essentially. But that's something where, again, kind of playing into the momentum aspect, when you have a lot of young voters, along with a lot of people who are, you know, actively going out to knock on doors to get voters to the polls, that's something where, you know, the Sanders campaign has had maybe more of an advantage. We saw that yesterday among the youth vote in Iowa. But, you know, going forward, we would probably expect to see a lot of those similar kind of demographic breakdowns in some of these other states as well.
I mean, Josh, on the Democratic side, we've got a grandma and a grandpa running for president.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of shocking. And I think it's particularly shocking that Sanders, that this grandfather had spoken to so many of kind of the youth vote, and you see it across. It's the one demographic where he manages to kind of cross the gender divide, where you see a lot of young female millennials really excited about Sanders. And I think that that is certainly unexpected in a larger sense. Here, I think in the larger looking ahead to the general election, the organization for the Democratic Party, obviously there wasn't the pure excitement of 8 years ago when Barack Obama was running here. But at the same time, there was an advantage in the sense that in 2008, the caucuses happened very early. There was this odd race for states to make sure to move up in the calendar. And Iowa ended up going, I believe, the first week of January when most college students were home for winter break. So they didn't caucus. And this time around, they were here. And so that, one, inflated Sanders' numbers, which would have helped if there would be a overall popular vote total. I think he might even be higher than Clinton. But in a larger sense, that allowed Sanders' campaign to organize and to get these kids out to the caucus. And if Hillary becomes the nominee, as long as she can protect that, ultimately it's easy to imagine a scenario where these young voters that might not normally show up on election day, after they've gone through this process and caucused, that they're more likely to remain excited kind of for the remainder of the year and maybe still be there to give her a push come November.
We got a lot of comments here, including email question from Nicole. She says, is there any truth to rumors that were circulating last night about Cruz sending out flyers alleging voter violations? Will we see more of this sort of accusation in New Hampshire? I know, Josh, you looked at this. Jesse, did you look at this as well?
Yeah, I did, and that was something that Cruz had to defend over the weekend, which he did, you know, saying he wouldn't make any kind of apologies for it. The Iowa Secretary of State had kind of rebuked him over it. And if you look, I think Senator Rand Paul had tweeted some photos of it. And if you look at it, you know, it's just a yellow sheet of paper with the word, you know, voting violation at the very top. And it kind of does look, to some extent, official. And so that opened up Cruz, you know, on the eve of the caucus to just blistering attack from several candidates, but especially Trump, who accused him, you know, of being a fraud and kind of peddling this false campaign mailer. So, you know, whether that kind of pops up in other states, maybe they'll be more careful. Maybe not if it doesn't necessarily break, you know, the rules.
Well, Josh, I mean, if I got something in the mail that said voter violation with my name on it, I'd be kind of nervous.
Yeah, I mean, it certainly is ethically dubious, to put it mildly. It doesn't seem to be illegal. It certainly is. What I think was so striking is that not only – so the flyers themselves, what they did is you would receive it and it would give you a rating of how you – what your kind of voting record is, and basically gave lots of people Fs in order to encourage them to come out. It doesn't look like those actual letter grades were based on anything in reality, but there is some social science behind it that suggests if you think that your neighbors know whether you're voting or not, you're more likely to feel that social and civil pressure to show up and caucus. And Cruz banked on that, and he targeted some of his supporters that he thought were likely to support him if they showed up, but perhaps less likely to leave the house. And this was a way to give them a little nudge, but a little shove by putting the fear of God, or I guess the fear of a voter violation.
Right, exactly. Fear of somebody. A Twitter comment from Nathan. He says, I found the first 5 minutes of Sanders and Cruz speeches were almost identical, touting the anti-establishment and criticizing the media. Interesting comment. Jesse, do you want to weigh in on that?
Sure. I think, you know, that's just been a major theme of this campaign, and something that many of these candidates, even, you know, Rubio, who is, you know, considered maybe the most establishment among the top tier candidates, have kind of leaned into kind of shedding any kind of connection to Washington and focusing on more of their grassroots appeal among conservatives, or in the case of Trump, you know, more blue collar workers. So that's certainly something that they're going to, you know, stress. And Sanders, even though he's been, you know, a senator, he's been in Congress, and I think Clinton even said a couple weeks ago that, you know, he's been in Congress longer than she has, trying to almost claim that he's maybe a little bit more establishment than she is. That's, you know, going for that kind of political outsider appeal is something that has benefited a lot of these candidates. You know, we saw Cruz and Trump at the top. We saw Sanders kind of performing better than expected in Iowa. I think that's just the first of a lot of states to come, where those who've been positioning themselves as the political outsider against, you know, even among Democrats, looking at the Obama administration, some of the exit polls pegged it at a third, wanting, you know, more liberal policies, are going even further than what we've seen in kind of the Democratic establishment over the last several years. You can't really discount that power of, you know, if you're not in the establishment, if you're not part of supporting those who are already in the system, it seems to be benefiting you. So, yeah, it's not really surprising to even see across party lines those kinds of parallels being drawn.
Talk about establishment, Josh. Jeb Bush, how did he do in Iowa last night?
It looked like he got, I think, a little under 3% of the vote, which is not necessarily the stunning result from a man who jumped in the campaign with promises of shock and awe. I guess they were shocking. I think New Hampshire is going to be very interesting for him. He was hoping, I think, that Rubio would stumble and look a little weak coming out of Iowa, kind of opening the door in New Hampshire, where he's locked in kind of a battle between Rubio and Kasich for kind of that establishment heat within the larger one. He does have a lot of money. That super PAC money hasn't had the impact that I think everyone thought it would be, but it's still there. And he can kind of stay around and try to burn down everyone's houses if he wants to. I'd be shocked if he doesn't fight on to South Carolina. There's always been kind of this speculation that if he got to South Carolina and really needed a bump, that George W. Bush would come out and campaign for him in South Carolina, where, kind of given the strong ties to the military, that he's pretty well-respected within the Republican electorate. And then recently, after Lindsey Graham dropped out, the senator from South Carolina, dropped out of the 2016 race, he endorsed Jeb, which was a little bit of a surprise, and suggests that after going through all of this, I can't imagine a scenario where Jeb doesn't at least fight on a little bit longer. That said, it would take a pretty big miracle for him to get back in the conversation, and that starts with Rubio stumbling in New Hampshire.
That Bush name, I guess, depending on what state you're in or what part of what state you're in, is a help or a hindrance, Josh?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is something that Democrats often kind of lose sight of, given their perceptions of what they think about the George W. Bush administration. But ultimately, the Bush name remains popular. Some of Jeb's had kind of difficulty deciding whether he wants to run towards the name or run away from it. Obviously, his campaign signs just say Jeb Bush, clearly
right.
Missing.
Yes.
But some of his stronger moments here recently have actually come by talking about his brother. In one of the debates, he had the line about the rubble of 9/11 that seemed to go well with their electorate. In this last debate, it was a Trumpless debate, mind you, which I think certainly left Jeb with a little bit more confidence than he normally has. He kind of opened with a strong kind of push of the, yes, my brother and my father were presidents. I guess that makes me establishment. Yes, my mother is Barbara Bush. I guess that makes me establishment. I'm fine with that. Which was owning this establishmentness in a way that I think is interesting, and it certainly has its risks. But at this point, I mean, he might as well take the big swings and hope he connects.
Jesse, what's interesting is the Democrats have been adding more debates. The party criticized for having fewer debates than the Republicans and kind of burying them in the weekend. Did this come from the candidates themselves? Where did this call for more debates in prime time come from?
Well, it's been something that Sanders and also Martin O'Malley, who, of course, dropped out last night after registering, you know, under 1%, have been calling for months, and that's been among, you know, liberals on and even some Clinton supporters kind of voicing frustration with the fact that there aren't more debates, you know, compared to even the last cycle in 2008. So to some extent, I mean, realizing the change in dynamic, I think starting in the new year, 2016, since, you know, early January, we've almost seen Sanders just surge in so many polls, especially in, you know, going into Iowa. He, of course, surged and had better expectations there. So at the same time, kind of realizing that the race is tighter between the two, I think we've kind of seen maybe the Clinton side maybe relent a little bit more and kind of agree to some of these debates. Clinton has kind of been widely viewed as a strong debater, and she's had some strong moments in the debates. So certainly, you know, having more opportunities to address voters, especially in New Hampshire, where she's, you know, down in the polls by wide margins in some, having more opportunities to debate is certainly going to help both of them. And so it's a gamble, but certainly, you know, could help her.
We have a Twitter comment from Montgomery County. I support Bernie Sanders because I want marijuana legalized. Josh, if Bernie Sanders becomes president, are we going to have legalized marijuana in the United States?
I think that would be a big lift, even for President Sanders, given the current makeup of Congress.
And we're almost at, no, go ahead.
Which is ultimately that one topic, if you take it to the broader, is certainly a central in the larger argument about the Democratic Party about kind of what is achievable today with the current makeup of a Republican-controlled Congress and kind of what could be achievable tomorrow in the future. And that's certainly a divide between the pragmatism of Hillary Clinton and kind of what executive levers she might be able to pull with her experience versus Bernie Sanders' larger call for his political revolution.
Well, we have to end on that note. Josh Voorhees, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thanks so much for having me.
You're welcome. Senior writer at Slate, living in Iowa. Iowa City, I should say. Take care of that voice. Jesse Burns, thanks for joining us as well.
Absolutely. Thank you, Marty.
You're welcome. Political reporter at The Hill. And we began with Catherine Lucy, government and politics reporter for the Associated Press. Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times, and you can find out much more about this program, including how to download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Thanks for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. And do stay with us. We'll be right back with Hour 2. And And coming up next on Radio Times, writing, composing, and singing Cold Mountain. We'll be talking about how this award-winning novel became an opera, having its East Coast debut in Philadelphia this week. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Next Move, Dance at the Prince, supports WHYY. Next Move presents Ezrelo Dance, directed by Daniel Ezrelo, the choreographer of the Sochi Winter Olympics. His inventive, physically explosive, and humorous troupe performs its regional premiere of Open at the Prince Theater February 3rd through the 7th. Open is a unique series of choreographic vignettes that combine a classical music score, inventive ideas, playful movement, and striking visuals. Tickets at princetheater.org.
This is WHYY-FM Philadelphia, WNJN-FM 89.7 Atlantic City, WNJZ 90.3 Cape May Courthouse, WNJB-FM 89.3 Bridgeton, WNJM 89.9 Manahawkin, and WNJS-FM 88.1 Berlin.
From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Radio Times. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. When Charles Fraser's novel Cold Mountain was published almost two decades ago, it won the National Book Award and sold millions of copies. It was later made into a movie, and now it's an opera, the first debuted in Santa Fe. Opera Philadelphia is presenting Cold Mountain for its East Coast premiere at the Academy of Music February 5th through 14th. Joining us are the author, Charles Fraser, the award-winning composer Jennifer Higdon, and acclaimed tenor J. Hunter Morris. Cold Mountain is this year's One Book, One Philadelphia selection. Stay with WHYY in Philadelphia for more after the news from NPR.